Hi, I'm Ellie Carter from Extended, and if you've been enjoying our podcast, we really need your help. We need a few moments of your time to review Extended on Apple Podcasts or on your podcast player. A 5-star review would be brilliant, and it would be great if you could add some text as well. The more positive reviews, the better chance we have of raising the profile of the podcast and bringing even more great guest content in the future. It will only take a few moments of your time, and we would really appreciate your support. Thank you.
Talk about some really smart people that came up with a design that has lived, like you said, for, you know, 5 decades. Because inherently, it is the same backbone and structure, right, that it once was. There's some modifications there. But the base design, you know, lightweight day VFR fighter that is maneuverable, it's powerful, that allowed it to grow into what it is today. The fact that you can slap all this stuff on it, they got the bones of it right.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended. Extended. It's time to talk aviation.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of Extended. My name's Gareth Stringer. I'm the editor of Global Aviation Resource and one of your erstwhile hosts for the show. This week, I'm delighted to welcome John Rainwaters to Extended. John is a former US Air Force F-16 combat pilot and demo pilot, and now, with the Afterburn podcast, has a burgeoning global audience and large following on social media. We're going to talk about a whole host of subjects, including the F-16, obviously, flying the jet in combat, displaying the jet, and we even touch on events in Ukraine. Although please note, this was recorded just 3 days after the start of hostilities. Enjoy the show. Rain, John Waters, welcome to Extended. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Absolutely, I am glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me on.
It's a real privilege to speak to you. I think we've all been watching and listening for the last couple of years, and you must be really chuffed with how it's going. I've got some numbers here. You got like 125,000 subscribers on YouTube, 155,000 on Instagram. God knows how many listeners to the podcast. It's incredible, isn't it?
It's really cool. It shows that there are people interested in, obviously, this topic, aviation. It's something I love, and being able to share it is a privilege, and I'm happy to do it, especially when I see, you know, young people who reach out, and now it's been going a couple of years. You get people who might have caught them in high school, and now they're pursuing an aviation career or something like that. So to me, it's humbling to be a small part of that.
We're going to talk about the Viper a little bit down the track, but I did wonder whether your time as the demo pilot was an influence on you doing this now. Obviously, that puts you out there and you're engaging with the public a lot more than you would just as a fighter pilot. I wondered if that was one of the triggers for you getting into doing this.
Absolutely. I separated from active duty, and in the process of getting out, transitioning to a civilian career, doing the reserves and things like that, I definitely had some time off and family was moving. And I kind of thought, you know, over the past like 2.5 years of my life, I've met some really incredible people that have incredible stories. And it'd be really great to capture those and share them. And at the time, I wasn't a big podcast guy listening to them. And I've joked on other podcasts, like I couldn't even spell podcast at the time. But I kind of landed on that. That was like this long format, bring people together and share stories. And I've been fortunate to stumble through it. I've had some people who've helped me out, like Jello over in the Fighter Pilot podcast. He was one of the first people to reach out to me. And I think it's a testament to show like this community where one might view it as competition and things of that nature. And some people do. He reached right out, said, "Hey, let me know whatever I can do to help you." And now there's kind of a band of us, like the Low Level Hell podcast, the Fighter Pilot podcast, the Afterburn podcast, where we all kind of come together and tips and tricks, and we'll meet every now and then and talk about stuff to be out there and share our different versions and our different stories that we've come across.
So you're actually the last of that little trilogy to appear on Extended. Yeah. Because Jello's been a guest, the Low Level Hell guys have been on very as nice. Well, and obviously there's CW Moyne as well, and that, yep. And it's something that's beginning to grow in the UK as well, with some of our fighter pilots, military pilots are beginning to get a bit more, so it's not just sort of enthusiasts like me, you know, anymore. Right. And it's brilliant, you've opened up a whole world to people. I don't know what is it about aviation, John, why is it, you know, it's your career, but it's your passion, it's something we love talking about it, don't we?
Yeah. And I think people, you know, there are a lot of professions out there that if you're truly passionate about, people love what they do when they go to work, when they wake up in the morning, and then to be able to share that with the next generation or other people. And if you're lucky enough to land in a profession like that, then it's not everyone, right? But I think it's more inherent that people are willing to take a little bit more time out of their day or put forth a little bit extra effort to share something. Like, I would love to be Joe Rogan and get, you know, paid to be a professional podcaster, right? It's not going to happen. It's something that it takes a lot of time out of your day. And it's funny you mentioned CW Loyne, Mover. So I was on his YouTube channel back in December, and then I was going to have him on the podcast. He got COVID. And now with my schedule, like, which is constant trying to line one another up. But the effort it takes to get us to be able to meet like this, even, you know, over the internet.
Yeah.
You know, we're crossing time zones, albeit right now you and I are relatively close. But there's a lot of logistics that go into it. And then we're going to hit end on this, and you're going to have to spend probably hours editing out
my bit out to me. Yeah.
Yeah. I think when you find something that you truly love, you're willing to put in a little bit extra effort. And the aviation community is obviously one of those communities where if people get the bug, they're willing to take the extra time, and they just want to be involved, and they want to be fully immersed in it.
It's probably something we don't talk about enough, really. But, you know, I think I said to Tim and Peter, my fellow presenters of the show, back in, God, when did I email you? It was like November or something. It's like, we've got to get rain on. And I said, I'll do it. I want to do it. And here we are, what, 3 months later or right. Whatever. It does take time. It's not easy. It's not easy. Yeah. We've all got other jobs and lives, and I know you've got right. I know you've got a couple of little bundles of energy at home, I'm sure, keeping you guys busy as well. So no, that's why, you know, I genuinely appreciate that we have managed to get this done. So
excited.
One of the things you do on the podcast, and we're going to come on to a bit of a specific example in a minute, it's not all fun and games, is it? There's lessons to be learned. You know, the military world particularly is it's a dangerous one. You haven't shied away from that, have you?
No, I think it's one of those things too, that when you look at pursuing a profession, hopefully you educate yourself as much as you can about it. You know, I was young when I wanted to go into the military and go fly. Looking back now, right, as you get a little bit older, and I'm not that old. I know there's guys who are much older than me that listen to this and say, he's young, right? But, you know, you throw an extra decade on your life, you look back and you know more than you did then. And now, you know, looking back, like, obviously you're buying a lot of risk when you're flying fighters. The business is to go out there and kill and break things, and you're flying high performance equipment that if you let your guard down for a second, or if you don't let your guard down for a second, and just, it's the Swiss cheese model, right?
Yeah.
All the, you know, the slices of Swiss cheese line up, and then something shoots right through, and that error is not captured. And that's it. Very talented, very capable people have found themselves in very difficult situations that they weren't able to overcome, right? And now looking back over the course of my short career, you know, I think you know, it takes more than one hand to count the friends that I've lost through aviation. And that is a fact of doing business.
But some of this also is very personal. And I want to talk a little bit about the three parts you did on Pyro. Will Dubois, he wasn't just an F-16 pilot. He was a colleague. He was a friend. And you put three episodes together. You know, Pyro, unfortunately, was killed in a tragic accident in 2014. I think, was it 2014?
Yep. And
Rain, you're not just talking about an F-16 accident there. You're talking about something very, very close to you. You were there. You were in the theater when it happened. And I think in some ways we should be saying thank you for that. But that can't be easy to do either. And the episode with Blitz was extraordinary because I sat there listening to it, and it was a little bit like a sort of counselling session. And Blitz at times was questioning himself and how he'd been at the time. I mean, thank you for doing that, but it's a real sort of step forward, isn't it? It's extraordinary.
You know, these things happen every day of the week, right? And every day of the year across the world, you know, people are lost. And we're seeing what's going on in Ukraine right now. Like, there are some people who are waking up and going to bed tonight that their lives are forever changed, and they're living very, very tough lives that I can't even imagine being put into. But it's very easy to see it on social media with a swipe, or to see it on the news and then carry on about your daily business. You know, but when you're right there and you're living it, obviously it's very personal. Pyro is very personal for me, for my squadron mates, obviously for his friends and family. You know, Blitz and I had talked for several months leading up to us recording that. I had recorded a previous episode on an F-16 pilot, Mezer, who was tragically killed in a mishap at Shaw. And that's what was kind of the genesis of this was, you know, Pyro, he's a person with a family. And to tell more than just the blip on social media or the news and to carry on his legacy, right? Not to say that, you know, my podcast, like, it's insignificant, right? But it is a platform that I was hopefully being able to, my intent was to lend it to other voices to build more around Pyro, to share more than the 7-second clip or the 15-second clip, and, you know, raise awareness about his life, the foundation his family started to continue his legacy. And, you know, it's just one of those things that I think it shows. Just, it's a blip. It shows the person Pyro was. And I was only able to capture, you know, the squadron mates that we were out there serving with. But, you know, he affected hundreds, if not thousands, of lives in a very personal manner. And then, you know, in just a matter of a couple seconds, it's all over. And that's the reminder that aviation is a dangerous business, right?
When you say that you and Matt Blitz were talking for all that time, was some of that to decide whether it was actually something you wanted to do, or was it more, how do we go about doing this?
Yeah. If you talk about like putting together a podcast, and just the challenge. So Mezer's episode released in January of 2021. And Blitz reached out to me, you know, we're still good friends. He was my boss at the time. It's funny to see who listens to the podcast. but he actually brought it up that he'd want to do something about it. So we had talked, you know, what is the structure of this? Like, how do we do it? How do we tell the story? How do we do it right? Because there is an aspect of it where, you know, he was the commander, and being, you know, someone who worked for him at the time, and, you know, there was a different relationship in 2014 than Blitz and I have today. He was the boss back then, right? So he's wearing the commander hat, and there's some things he can share and some things he could share and some things he couldn't. Much more open now because he can. He's retired. But he carried a lot of that weight. Like, I think a lot of people carry different pieces of it. And I had, you know, friends from the squadron. It impacted, like everything, it impacts people in different ways. Where some people after the episodes came out said, hey, look, I really wanted to do something. I couldn't do it. Like, people still to this day carry the weight of that of that deployment and what happened on that deployment, that they're still not to the point where they can talk about it. And for Blitz to be willing to come out and talk about it, because he carries a lot of that burden on his shoulders. And as we discussed in the episode, I try not, like, I was there, right? So there's a bias of what was happening, and you know, people haven't listened to it. Obviously it's out there, but the summation of it, you know, Pyro, he crashed short of the runway. That place was the darkest place I'd ever flown in my life.
Those bits were extraordinary. When you, sorry to interrupt, when you were talking about the environment in which you were flying in, and you know, you gave the whole thing context, obviously, that which was a really important part of it for me.
Yep.
When you were talking about that and how dark it was like, God, I would never have thought of that. And that was extraordinary.
Well, and so I mentioned earlier, right? Like, Pyro is more than the 7-second clip on social media. Well, when there's a mishap, the Air Force does two things: safety investigation board and accident investigation board. They run separately. The accident investigation board gets released. And in Pyro's case, I think this is a 36-page document, which doesn't really provide the context, especially in this case, in my opinion. And again, it is a process, right? It was a fatality. So there's a general that is the president of the board, and those are his findings. I don't feel like they did a thorough job with Pyro's, and that was a piece of why we wanted to do this. Like, for instance, the mishap board does place a lot of blame on the squadron, saying guys were cutting corners and doing things like this for the approach. Like, I was a night guy. I was one of a very few, you know, we had people who flew days predominantly and people who flew nights predominantly. I was one that flew nights predominantly. And not to say they would interview me on the process, but I can attest that I don't think they really interviewed anyone on the night train, as we call it, as far as how we were flying procedures. And that aspect of it, I think, ate away at Blitz a little bit. I know it did. And being able to bring all these facts together, to at least, not that it's our side of the story, right, or his side of the story, but to shed more light and let the people kind of, you know, they can read the accident investigation board, they can hear what Blitz has to say, and then they can make their determination. And the end of the day, unfortunately, Pyro made a series of mistakes that, you know, cost him his life. I think there are things that could have been done that would have made things safer. Like, we have instrument approach systems. We spend a lot of money on frivolous stuff, not frivolous stuff. We spend a lot of money on things that, you know, maybe if we put the weight behind it, would have made it more safer. And that's Monday morning quarterback, right? Crystal ball,
yeah.
Or hindsight's 2020, right?
Yeah, but, yeah.
I think doing that, the episode with Blitz in particular was important to build that context around it.
Well, it was a captivating listen, and thank you for doing that. It's a pretty amazing piece of work. It's not all on those lines, though. I mean, you've had some amazing guests, haven't you, who've flown some amazing aircraft, and I guess that's at the heart of it, isn't it?
It is. You know, it's a mix, too. Like, I've also had, people on there who are not pilots. Like,
yeah,
I say, you know, early on, Caleb Brewer, I always bring him up. Caleb Brewer, he's a Green Beret. He stepped on a pressure plate ID in Afghanistan. I had met him, and I've told this story before, but it was an air show weekend, or in between air shows. I was on Huntington Beach, California. We finished the air show, and rather than go back to South Carolina, we just stayed for a few days and went to San Francisco for the next air show. But in the meantime, we met people who wanted to teach us to surf. Not a surfer, and if you've seen it, it was very apparent. But it was amazing going out there. A team of like 11 of us went out, and everyone, you know, that's the culture there is surfing, right? Like, the fire chief was coming out of the water like at 7:15 in the morning. He was wrapping up. He was like, hey, I'm going to stay. I'm going to teach you guys to surf. It was a whole slew of people did. But Caleb was out there and he was surfing. And again, spoiler alert, like, Caleb, like, he lost his legs due to that IED.
Yeah.
And he was smoking me and everyone else surfing. Like, I was out there like a fish out of water just trying to survive. But, you know, it's guys like from Caleb and telling his story to a friend, Les Dyer, who's an SR-71 pilot. You know, it spans the gamut. Yeah. And so it's cool to be able to bring these people together and share stories.
And you got a mutual friend, Purty, told his, you know, some of the most famous images, ejection images, yeah, you're ever likely to see, and it was brilliant to hear him telling that whole story. And that, again, it's just an extraordinary tale, isn't it?
It is. And so Purdy, and that answers how small the aviation world is. Obviously, he's very well spoken, very accomplished, and the images of him ejecting in the Harrier, I mean, seen around the world. He, to me, is an incredible human being. Part of being a fighter pilot, right, is like owning stuff and talking about it, sharing stories. And he does a phenomenal job of talking through what happened and sharing it. You know, I think there might be a tendency of people when they make a mistake to shy away from sharing things, and he walks through it. And the great part of his story, right, is one of the great parts of his story is the fact that, you know, at the end of him sharing a story with squadron mates of what happened, like every single one of the guys in the room's like, yeah, that could have been me. And I think that's an important piece of aviation is, you know, there, the difference between it going all right and it all going wrong is a matter of like a slight head fake left or right, you know, and you just don't know how it's going to shake out. I think I told on that episode, like one of my biggest mistakes where I thought I was going to go off the end of the runway into the ocean. And it was from not studying an airfield map. I was in Africa in a field, and it was just chalking away the basics and saying, whatever, I don't need to worry about this. I'm worrying about the tactics and going out here. And I just forgot the very, very basic stuff. So, and I was an experienced guy at that point. So it can happen to anyone for sure. And if you don't think it can, it's you now.
Yeah, definitely. Rain, we all know that fighter pilots, military pilots, you know, guys and girls in the bar telling flying stories. Have you encountered any reticence to say to somebody, look, you know, I want to get you to tell these stories, but in a completely different environment, an environment like this?
People, I guess, yeah. And this is weird, right? Like, this is podcasting, social media. The world is opening up to different things that you would not have normally been exposed to, right? And again, like, I got to go back to like why I want to do this. I'm trying to get Vietnam guys onto my podcast. A lot of guys, the stories that those guys have, you know, they live between four walls in a hut in Southeast Asia, and like they're gone forever, you know. So trying to capture those stories is, I think, super important. And now the technology exists to be able to go out there and do that.
Yeah. Any joy?
What's that? So I've had one so far, and actually in the process of lining up another one who F4 guy during Vietnam, a lot of incredible accolades.
Amazing.
And became a high school principal of all things after the war. So, but it's one of those things, trying to line up schedules. So hopefully I'll get that recorded here in the next few weeks.
Excellent. Rain, let's talk about you and the Air Force for a minute. Did you always want to fly?
I did. Well, yeah, at some point, you know, I didn't or didn't know anything about it. And it was middle school for me. So I was probably, you know, young teenager when the bug started to land. I went flying with a neighbor in a Piper Cub on a beautiful day. It was like 70 degrees. I don't know what that converts to. It's probably what, like 20
C, something like that. So.
It's very nice. Right. And a Piper Cub, door open on a beautiful day. And like, that was kind of the hook initially. And then I had my first flight for my pilot's license in high school on September 10th, 2001.
Yeah.
And again, that's one of those days, obviously marked on everyone's calendar and etched in everyone's in minds. And, you know, for me then it was, I definitely want to go serve in the military. And if I can go fly and serve, then that's a win-win. So definitely a catalyst for me to jump into the path that I went.
But you didn't go straight through training to stream from fast jet to F-16, did you? Was your path to the Viper a little unusual? Were you essentially what we would call a creamy over here? So you finished your flight training and were creamed straight back to be an instructor, which is kind of the accolade that's brilliant, but nobody really wants because they want to get to the front line, right?
Yeah, I don't think anyone wants to be a FAPE. We call them FAPEs, first assignment instructor pilots.
Have you heard, creamy? You've heard that phrase, have you?
I have. Yeah. So at Shaw, we have three fighter squadrons in those fighter squadrons, we have a Marine, so that's a U.S. exchange pilot, and then the two other squadrons. So we have a Dutch exchange pilot in the squadron I was part of, and then the other squadron had a British exchange pilot.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
So Carney introduced me to what a creamy was.
Okay.
Carney, he was actually going through the F-16 transition when I was going through the B course.
Right.
So I started out as a first-time instructor pilot in the T-6. So I hung around beautiful Columbus, Mississippi for a few extra years after training, and I instructed in the T-6. I did a short stint deployment to Afghanistan while I was a FAPE in the MC-12. So
yeah,
I've King Air 350.
Okay.
Yeah, doing intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, which was interesting. It was good to get that exposure. I went back to the T-6 for a few months and then transitioned to the T-38 for introduction to fighter fundamentals and then on to the F-16 after that. So, yeah, a roundabout way of getting to the F-16, which is not too uncommon in our Air Force. I want to say, you know, like, and again, it varies from year to year. Like, my year group, there weren't very many F-16 pilots. And I think, in fact, the Air Force probably had like 15 to 17 in my year group. And of those, maybe two or three were straight from pilot training to the F-16. The rest were all FAPES because they just didn't produce a lot of F-16 pilots in that year group. That's a whole nother story, which I think I talk about in some of my other podcast episodes. But roundabout way of getting to the old Viper.
Just tell me about the T-38 briefly. This is an aircraft that has a bit of a reputation, doesn't it?
It does. So for me, I really enjoyed flying the T-38. Also, at the end of flying the T-38, I was happy to be done with it. It's a plane that is unforgiving. I mean, it's got two credit card wings, you know, sized wings. It's decently powered, and I use that term very gracefully. I had a buddy who was killed in the T-38 right before I started pilot training, which, again, that was kind of the welcome to, like, hey, this is real. And you just had to learn to respect it because, again, it's one of those things that if you stop paying attention, if you let your guard down for a second, it can kill you. But, I mean, we fly it hundreds of thousands of hours, right, and do it safely. But, again, it's just a reminder that, you know, you must respect the machine and give it its due credit and respect. But the T-38, it's old. I think the youngest one I flew might have been like a 71 model.
Wow.
They're bent. They all kind of do something.
That's
a little bit
even
different.
Older than me. I mean,
yeah, they're all a little quirky, but it's a fun plane to fly. It's fast. You know, you can go a decent distance. And I say that again, you know, before it gets F-16 is obviously the best. It doesn't compare. It's apples and oranges, but the T-38 is fun. We're replacing it with the T-7. Which will be interesting to see as we bring that on. I think it's going to have some capabilities. Our pilot, the way we do everything as technology evolves is changing and shaping how we do things, and rightfully so. But the T-7 is going to be something new, and it's going to just transform, I think, how we train people and potentially how we go out there and fight.
Did you know that Imperial Airways flying boat services in the 1930s were not always the glamorous experience we imagine? They tended to be cold, noisy, and the food was lukewarm at best. One passenger said that when he mentioned to friends and colleagues that he'd booked a ticket, half of them said, "People never travel twice by Imperial." Did you also know that in the 1950s, the Royal Aircraft Establishment at Farnborough came up with a concept for a hypersonic personal transport pod, propelled by ramjets on its rotor tips and covered in glass fibre fur to dissipate surface heat at Mach 5? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
Yeah, we'll maybe come on to some of this generational stuff in a minute, but I guess we've already made some of these changes in the UK. Obviously, we're on a completely different scale to you, but, you know, we've got Hawk T2 now, so we've got digital cockpits in training aircraft, which clearly helps people with the next step. I'm guessing, you know, T-38 to F-35 is ridiculous in a sense, isn't it?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, I haven't jumped to the F-35 piece of, but...
Or Raptor, yeah, I guess, you know.
It is one of those things that the F-16 is an easy plane to fly. And I think the F-35 and the F-22 are easy planes to fly. there's obviously a lot that goes into it, right? But inherently, it's managing all the systems that that plane has, managing the tactics and the battle space and the gaining situational awareness and sharing situational awareness. That's the piece that's challenging. You know, the F-16, especially a Block 50 doing the SEED mission, the suppression of enemy air defense mission, you know, if you did the cockpit study for how many people need to be sitting in that jet today, you know, when they built it, it'd be a complement of two. There's so much going on. That's the real challenge. But, you know, F-16, you let off the stick, like the plane's just going to keep doing what it's doing. Yeah. Like, you know, it's, again, I think inherently an easy plane to fly once you get a few reps under, or, you know, a few reps in it. But, you know, having that modern technically advanced trainer with glass cockpit will, I think, help translate. And they're going to be able to do some stuff like, a simulated radar, learning basic corporate that. So that aspect, I think, will make better wingmen down the future, I think.
So did you always want Viper, or was it only when you got to Viper that you kind of fell in love with Viper, or was that what you was eyes were always on that as the prize for you?
It was not always what I wanted. And I joke about one of the episodes with Satan, who's an A-10 pilot now. He wanted the Viper. I wanted the A-10 alpha training. I put A-10 then Fate. Because I was like, if I can't go fly the A-10 the first round, I want to go fly it the second round. Like another look at being a Fate. Because I want to go do a close air support. I felt that was the best way to get in the fight. I knew if I go fly an A-10, I'm going to go get in the fight. And then I did the MC-12 deployment as a FAPE. And for me, that was a very fortunate, it was a very good deployment for me for various reasons. One of which, I was exposed to a lot of fighter guys who were also doing the same thing I was doing. They were just borrowed from their cockpit for 9 months or so. But I was exposed to a lot of Viper guys, McIntyre Air National Guard unit, which is right down the road from Shaw, where I was based. Those guys were deployed there at the same time. It allowed me to learn more about the Viper and the mission that I previously was uneducated about. And so that switched. And while I was deployed, I owed my dream sheet for my next assignment, if you will. And I put F-16 first, and I was fortunate enough to get it. So worked out.
Now, here we are. We're not too far from 50 years since the aircraft flew, albeit inadvertently, I think, for the first time. Clearly, the F-16 now is very different to then.
Yeah,
this is a hugely successful aircraft. I seem to say this to a lot of guests when I talk to them, but it will be an icon. You know, it will go down in aviation history. What were the fundamentals, though, that they did so right nearly half a century ago that makes the aircraft still relevant today?
Man, you talk about some really smart people that came up with a design that has lived, like you said, for, you know, five decades. Because inherently, it is the same backbone and structure, right? Yeah. That it once was. There's some modifications there, but the base design, you know, lightweight day VFR fighter that is maneuverable, it's powerful, that allowed it to grow into what it is today. The fact that you can slap all this stuff on it. Granted, engines are different, but the wires are different than in it. The core, they got the bones of it right. Which, you know, to me, again, you think about what they were dealing with. There's no supercomputers when they're designing this. You know, I mean, it was abacus and slide rules and things like that, which is just wild. But now that this thing is, you know, it is able to be scalable, it's able to be adaptable, and as technology has evolved, being able to very easily slap things in there. Now, it's not as modular as I think if you design something today, how you can plug and play and change things out. Like, those are the things we've learned over the years. And I'm not an engineer, right? So not a very smart person. But I think today, if you design the F-16 with the fact that you would want to be able to grow it and scale it into different things, might be a factor. But again, I think a testament to the incredible engineering and the forethought that the teams had as they went around and built the F-16 is incredible.
I interviewed Grat, who was the Belgian F-16 display pilot, a few years ago. I remember him saying that occasionally, if any of his technicians had a panel off or whatever, he'd wander over and have a look inside. And he said he always wished he hadn't, because when you saw what was kind of behind, the, it was like, oh, okay, that looks pretty old.
I'll say it, because the very, I think the best part of being the demo pilot for us in the U.S. is, you know, for us, we had three jets and a dedicated team of maintainers. That was our world, right? We were a separate spot. So it allowed me to do, you know, be more a part of maintenance, if you will. Like when they're pulling an engine, I can go out there and like, they let me turn a wrench, right? They're like, you know, pat me on the back, like, good job, you know, like stand off the side. But I saw more than I would have, you know, being just a line fighter pilot, because I had more time to do that stuff. But I remember seeing what holds the wings on, and it's just a couple big bolts. And, you know, in the demo, right, there's, at that point, I had several just amazing photos, tail aspect with the wings just bent up. Yeah. And you're like, I don't know if I'm comfortable. So, yeah, now you're like, you just think about it every time you pull 9Gs. You're like, it's just a couple bolts they did. So, yeah.
Now, you obviously, you did an operational tour in the F-16. How do you some look back maybe now at that experience of taking the jet into combat? You know, would you want to take another jet into combat, or did you get in that F-16 every night in that pitch black and think, you know what, I'm pretty glad this is what I'm strapping myself into?
No, I was very happy and very fortunate to be able to go do that. Like, that's what I joined for. Like, I wanted to go out there and take the fight. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Out there. And so there are many people that right place, wrong time, will never get to deploy. People showed up to our squadron, you know, 2 or 3 weeks before we were deploying, but it was too late for them to go. And same, they showed up right as we got back. And then that meant they would miss the next deployment cycle because they would be getting ready to move to their next base, just the way it works. So I was fortunate, right place, right time, that I was able to go out there and do that. And again, that deployment was unique. It was coming, you know, after, you know, basically 13, 14 years of operations in Afghanistan and then Iraq and then a pause in Iraq. But, you know, I did MC-12s in Afghanistan. And I remember listening to one of the McIntyre guys as they were getting ready to drop ordnance. Like, the guy was a lawyer in the cockpit. He was reading off the ROEs verbatim to the guys who were getting shot at the ground, because the environment at the time was so, you know, civilian casualty conscious.
Yeah.
Not that that's a bad thing, right?
Yeah.
But you had to be a lawyer to do that. You know, juxtaposed to our deployment, ISIS was everywhere, right? Like, throw something on the map and it's ISIS. So you went out there and did fighter pilot stuff every day, which, again, not many people had the opportunity to do what we did in the previous, you know, decade or so. So fortunate to be able to go do that. I was, again, lucky.
Do you still feel like a fighter pilot now? Do you think you'll always be a fighter pilot?
I think inherently the way you think and act and then, you know, attack problems, you know, much more than I think just a fighter pilot, right? You know, husband, dad, and you, that is one aspect of my life, right? That I'm very proud of. If I got to go strap on a jet again today, I would go do it. But also, like, there are more things in life than just being a fighter pilot. So for me, I'm in a happy spot. Like, I got young kids. So being able to raise them and be around them, give them stability, is very important for me. And that's not a sacrifice, right? Like, I'm very fortunate that I can go out there and provide for my family. If I was a single guy who didn't have any responsibility, I mean, my life would probably look a little bit different, like most people, right? But and obviously there are people who have families that are fighter pilots that continue on well past me. For me, it was the right time for my family to do something different. And my wife and my son, who was young at the time, my wife really sacrificed, because she is the one getting drug around country, who couldn't have a career and things like that. Yeah. So, you know, at some point, everyone makes a different decision. The family was, and what we needed to do, weighted more than being a fighter pilot.
Now, I know from interviewing a lot of demo stroke display pilots over the years that you need the planets to align for that to happen, again, you've just said it, sort of right place, right time. How did that come about for you?
Right place, right time. you joke about it and I'll say it, but that is, I think, so much of it, right place, right time, with the right qualifications. I'll add that caveat on there.
So when you get to shore, Rain, sorry to interrupt, when you get to shore, are you immediately thinking, oh, demo pilot, that could be something?
No, actually, I was actually deploying, right? So we were spent to deploy, and the demo team had just stood back up. And I remember one of the corner markers for the profile was our squadron building. And so Rocket was... he was standing back up after sequestration. He comes screaming over the building. I was like, that's awesome. But that's all I thought about it. Yeah. And then back to, all right, let's go get ISIS. And I want to say fast forward, you know, come back from the deployment. Shaw had the first air show they had in several years. It was 2016. I was staying home. Carney, who is our British exchange pilot, was in charge of putting on the air power demo. We had most of the wing was deployed TDY to Nellis for a major red flag. And I was back home and he asked if I would help out with it. And I ended up being like the narrator for our air power demo.
Okay.
So yeah, I went to the air boss brief the day before the air show to explain what was going on. I had a couple buddies who were Thunderbirds and I hadn't seen them in years. And so, you know, I saw the Canadian Hornet demo. We had the Viper demo. We had the Thunderbirds there. Maybe one other jet. I mean, it was just filled with jet teams, right? And so I remember talking to my Thunderbird buddy. I was like, hey, do you like doing this? Like after a couple of days, like, you like doing this? So yeah, it's great. I love it. And, you know, as luck would have it, about 3 weeks later, they sent out an email saying, hey, we're soliciting for the next demo pilot. If you're interested, you know, this is the package you need to put forward and yada, yada, yada. So I did some discussing with the wife and talked to a few more friends about it and ended up throwing my name in the hat. But again, I was getting ready to leave Shaw. I had an assignment to go to Holloman to be a B course instructor.
Okay.
So the stars were just aligning that, again, right place, right time. You know, better lucky than good.
And what was the process? I guess the fact that you can fly the demo is probably taken as a given, but is there an interview process? Because obviously there's a whole side to this job that you won't have done before in terms of the engagement and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah. So that's the piece. It, you know, Shaw does it all in-house. So if you're a Viper pilot at Shaw, you can apply and do it. The Raptor does, like I call it, Raptor Nation. So they'll solicit across all the F-22 bases just because the F-22 borrows jets. They don't have their own jets for the demo team. And you know, for us, since we all do it in-house, like it's pretty easy just to go out there and say, hey, go, you want to do this? Yep. All right. Put forth, you got to put out a resume. You send it to your boss, you know, he's the first filter to it. And then it goes up to the group commander who has all three squadrons. And that's where I did my first interview. And they know you, right? They know your background. They know your flying history. And I think it's kind of just like a sanity check. I don't know. But then the next interview is like with the wing commander. He's like, does the whole interview and then says you're hired. Because with the demo, like I'd say 99.8% of F-16 pilots can fly it. It's just different. Like you're not used to pulling 9 Gs at 300 feet. Like that's just not something you do on a routine basis.
Yeah.
But with enough training, anyone can do it. So inherently, they just kind of bank on you'll be able to do it. And then, you know, the public aspect of it, I'll say like we do a little bit of training, but the requirement is to show up, get to the show safely, fly the show safely, and then get home safely. Yeah. There's no other requirement to do anything else. I think demo pilots do varying levels of engagement. I think it's more so now with social media, but in the past, it might just be like, hey, what's up? I'm out. And then that was it. But you really make the money for recruiting by going out there and doing the show line and engaging people and doing different things, I think, which you kind of figure that out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what were your thoughts when they said, Rain, you've got the job, you're the demo pilot? Was it something you kind of immediately, did you have a lot of ideas or things you wanted to do? Do you have any leeway with the actual routine that you're going to going to fly. I've spoken to the guys over here, like the Eurofighter, the Typhoon pilots, and, you know, they'll sit immediately. They go home, you know, open a beer, get a blank piece of paper, put this schedule down. They'll run into work the next day, get in the simulator, realize it doesn't work at all, you know, or they've got no fuel left or whatever. Did you go through all of that stuff, or is it like, here's a book and that's what you're doing?
Yeah, here's a book. That's what you're doing. We have it scripted out. You know, it's been vetted. We can do some massaging of the profile. Like we can change a few maneuvers. That's really the repositions that we can modify the most. Not that that's like a significant modification or anything, but yeah. You know, my goal, like most people, unless they're enthusiasts, they're just like, they're out there. It's loud. It's jet noise. They're clapping. Yeah. They're exciting. But I think people do who have a keen eye for it start to notice how you fly the profile. And it's like, maybe I'm just going to hang inverted, you know, for 10 seconds on this reposition. Whereas most people would just roll right up, right? You know, because it just looks a little bit, maybe adds a wing flash.
Yeah.
Things like that. But it's cool to talk to the counterparts. And I got to do the Dubai show and the Bahrain show. And that's where you get to really meet display pilots from other countries and see their process. And like I mentioned, we had the Dutch exchange pilot in our squadron. And when they had their demo, they actually developed the profile and then sent it off to a university and had it vetted by like their aerospace engineering department. I was like, that's really cool. I was like, I wonder if we've actually ever done that, or is this just some fighter pilots in a sim who put it all together? Because, you know, they would figure out the energy profile.
Yeah.
Again, the F-16 is pretty easy. 330 to 440 knots, that's the Corning velocity of the F-16. If you stay in that realm, like, life's usually going to be pretty okay for you.
Now, of course, we've seen all of your demo stuff from every angle. Because one thing you have done brilliantly is you captured so much footage. Was that something you intended to do right from the start? Because everyone else has really had the benefit of that. And if I could just add as a second part to this, you've also captured a lot of footage of having non-pilots in the back of your a two-seat F-16, which is always fascinating, I think, to those of us who aren't fighter pilots. I've been lucky enough to have a couple of fast jet flights. Nothing like sitting behind you while you're flying a demo, but I know what an uncomfortable alien atmosphere that is to be in. But that's great fun, isn't it? But also there is a serious part to that. These are guys and girls who have worked their asses off, who then get that as their thank you very much. That must have been great fun for you.
Yeah, so I'll answer reverse order, because one, the doing the fam flights, we call them, was by far one of the best parts of the job. Yeah. Like being able to share that. And I think in that time span, I probably did 80 or so of them. And again, it was one of those things that I had a great team that in the off season, we said, you know, we could either do the minimum, right? Or, which is me fly every so often to stay current. But if you're willing to hump it, we'll get 2D models down here and we will fly nonstop. So it was not uncommon for us to fly, you know, 5 to 10 times a week in the off season.
Wow.
Which a lot of those would be putting the maintainers up. And there's a lot that goes into it. You know, it's like getting, you know, they have to meet with a flight doc. They have to get their egress training. They have to get their, their flight gear fitted. Like there's a lot that goes into it. So it was everyone from, you know, the survival specialist, to the maintainer, to air traffic control that were able to put in the back seat. And, you know, maybe they're masochists. They just want to watch each other like suffer. So, you know, it's, you know, we record it and then, you know, immediately they, you know, come in, park the jet, button it up real quick. And then everyone's inside to watch their buddy's GoPro footage to see, you know, just the pain they went through. So I was like, ugh. I had to ride in the backseat a lot for the upgrades, which is a terrible experience, let alone if you don't know what's really going on.
There's that thing about it. It's not your G, is it? If you haven't got the stick,
it's terrible. Terrible. Especially if you're training a new demo pilot, because you're like, you know, I was terrible when I started. And, you know, you're training someone who's terrible and like, you know, it should be happening. And then it's surprise 9 G's. Yeah. You just don't know what's going to happen. But being able to record all that was something new. The GoPros had existed, and the Air Force, I think, has done a good job with like embracing this, because I see it now happening in trainers and things like that. Definitely. For like a GoPro. If you turn on a GoPro, like, the plane's going to explode. Like, no, it's going to be fine. But when I became the demo pilot, the only thing I knew social media-wise was Facebook. We had a Facebook page for the Viper demo team. And I was like, I don't know, maybe we had like a couple, we had like 2,000 or 3,000 followers. Like, hey, I think social media is how we reach more people. When we go to an air show, it broadens the reach. So let's grow our Facebook page. And that was our big kind of public affairs push on the team, was to grow that. And we grew it to like, you know, 50,000 followers or something. And the next year I figured out what Instagram was. And I honestly, I flew, I had some great public affairs on the team. And then I had one person in particular who was not that great. He just like, yeah, if you've seen one air show, you've seen them all, which I disagree.
Yeah.
But our GoPro footage was not being downloaded. It was just being recorded over. And then also it wasn't being put out. I'm like, this content needs to be shared. Like, if you share a 30-second clip, people haven't seen this. Like, this is a built-in recruiting commercial that the Air Force would love to have.
If someone would charge you millions for that, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So, again, I didn't know what Instagram was. I got it. And then I started just putting up, you know, raw clips of like, be the takeoff or doing a loop, you know. I mean, it's just the audio, it's just the jet noise from the cockpit. And people, I think people really enjoyed seeing that aspect. And then we got a 360 camera at Oshkosh. Buddy Josh Mormon, who works for Garmin, helped us kind of navigate that space. And I think that melted the internet. That's what it really took off. You know, now it's, I have my YouTube channel. I'm just now kind of going through my hard drive, you know, because everything's like 8 gigabytes. You know? By the time you get it all. So uploading that and sharing it, because I remember, it's funny, Mickey, who was a Belgian demo pilot.
Mid 2000s.
I do remember watching, he had a video on YouTube. I probably watched it 500 times. The cool part of that is like, man, that's so awesome. And then especially when I got the F-16, so I was like, that's badass. Like, yeah. I want to go do that. Fast forward, I show up to my B course training and Mickey is one of my instructors. He's a, you know, Belgian exchange out there. So it's pretty cool. So I think those videos have their value and hopefully lands, you know, in some kid's tablet or computer, and maybe they want to go pursue flying or something in engineering.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
We were sat here chilling out the other night, and knowing this was coming up, I was just flicking through your YouTube channel, and I just couldn't help but just click play on a couple. And there was one of my wife was sat on the other sofa, and she just looked up at the TV and went, "That's Miami." And I was like, "Yeah, it is." And she's like, she recognized, yeah, she'd been there. She recognized it. It was quite funny.
That's awesome.
the other thing you get to do in the States is the heritage flights. And I guess there's two sides to this again. The first thing is how important they are from a historical perspective in terms of bringing the past and the present together, which I know will be very important to you. Other thing I guess everyone's interested in is, you know, how the hell do you fly a modern day fighter next to a P-47 or a P-51 or whatever it might be? You have a whole separate little training period for that, do you not? Is that right?
We do, yeah. Every year in February, March is actually going to happen here. I think the first week of March, they'll do the Heritage Flight Training Conference out in Davis-Monthan, Tucson, Arizona. So all the Warbird pilots who are checked out, there's about 10 civilian. I think they're adding 2 new guys to the team this year. And then all the demo teams will go out there and they'll spend 4 days really of flying, a day of academics. But it's the busiest I've ever, probably not the busiest I've ever been, but you're flying 3 or 4 times a day. You're just exhausted, but it's amazing because you're going up there and you'll be in a formation with a P-51, two F-86s, right? And you'll fly three or four iterations of the Heritage profile. You'll do some demo to burn down gas. It's an incredible training program. And that the piece of being able to showcase, you know, air power over 75 years, I think is pretty incredible. You know, you got a P-51, which turned the tide of the war, flying right alongside an F-35, you know, the future. So, and then you look at what man has accomplished in that time span of aviation, you know, from the Mustang to this, you know, modern day stealth fighter that can do some incredible stuff is really cool. But the challenge of flying next to those planes, one, you're flying 3 feet from this priceless warbird with no ejection seat. So don't hit them, right? That's going to be bad on many fronts. But all of them handle a little bit different. I'd say that, you know, the Mustang and the Viper do really well together. It's a pretty easy formation. The Mustang does a pretty decent job. You know, it's cruising around 240 knots or so. Not super fast, right? Yeah. But the Viper can hang there. It's not yelling at you. You put a Viper with a P-47 or an A-1 Sky Raider, and the jet's just yelling at you the entire time. Like, yeah, what are you doing? So each of them, you know, the jet's just handling. It's more sluggish. It's just not where it wants to be. The challenge for the demo, and, yeah, this is where internally I try to be better, is we sometimes do in front of the crowd rejoins. And that's right. You know, I finished. So one, you're communicating to the Mustang pilot or the Warbird pilot, right? Your last three maneuvers. So there's a lot of timing and skill that goes in on their part to be over show center when I'm about ready to rejoin. But in the F-16, you finish that last pass doing about 600 knots and you're pulling 9.5 G's for 10 plus seconds across the crowd line. And then going from 600 knots to 250 knots in about 180 degrees of turn. Wow. To get rejoined at 250 knots Mustang's wing. You're G'ing your face off, you're trying to bleed away the airspeed. You're trying not to be a, you know, clown out there. That was the biggest challenge for me, is going from that point to being on the wing of the Warbird, which was all, it was fun. It's fun to do. My neck feels it still, but it was fun.
Just on a slight aside, people might be interested when they're watching your YouTube videos from your demo, how much you're actually talking to other people whilst you're flying the routine. Now, I guess to some extent that's us projecting the, oh my God, how on earth is he doing that? And he's doing that. Yeah. But yeah, when you're in airspace and you've got other aircraft to join up with, you've always got people to talk to, haven't you? That you need to talk to.
Yeah. So, I mean, different, you know, from the air show, maybe it's a little bit different because running two radios, running a VHF radio that you're talking to the Warbird or anyone else in the formation airborne wise with, or the air boss is going to be a one of those potentially. Usually that gets turned down once you start the demo. And then you have your safety observer, who's another F-16 pilot that's standing next to the air boss at show center. That's going to read your checklist, because getting your checklist out is an emergency in itself. If something goes wrong or if there's something weird, that's your eyes and ears on the ground, but it can be busy. And then differing from when I do the familiarization flights, or when I did them rather, you know, you're talking to air traffic control, you're going out to the airspace. Usually once you're in the airspace, no one's wanting to talk to you, but then you got the passenger in the back. And my take on it was, I had been the passenger in the back in younger days, right? No idea what's going on. So trying to talk as much to let them know what's going to happen, even though, I mean, I think I joke about it later on. It's like, you can say whatever you want. People are like, yeah, okay. Yeah. Like, you know, the situational awareness you have, and rightfully so, is just completely destroyed because you've been crushed by 9 G's up to like 10 times this point. You know, I'm just having a great time up front. So
I think my favorite, was he a mate of yours? It was a C-130 pilot you had in the back. I don't know. Maybe it was just me. It seemed to be extra punishing. I don't know if that was.
I was with my buddy Ty. So funny. Yeah, small world, right? Like, I met him on my MC-12 deployment. He was flying C-130s. Fast forward, you know, almost 10 years later, and I'm the demo pilot, and he is working at Shaw on a staff tour. And so I had great bosses. I was like, hey, I want to put him in the pit and let him experience it. So he did phenomenal, right? Like, I don't think I've shared it. I had one of my buddies who's very experienced in the back seat. It was an overcast day, much like the one in that video with Ty. And at the end of it, he's like, I had no idea where the airfield was half the time. You know, like, he's like, I don't know how you do this. roll left to go right, roll right.
I think a lot of people don't necessarily realize, do they? It's those gray days when you're under the weather, when you are really earning your corn, and it's very, very physical, isn't it?
Yeah, the days where it's the low show and it's no getting a low show because of the cloud deck, it's a very high G. And, you know, that's one of the things too, is I did a show in Oceana, Virginia, NAS Oceana. And that day it was Scosh, formers were canceling, like 1500 feet is what I needed. And it was ragged. It was like 1200 feet, then 1700 feet, then 1500 feet, you know, just went back and forth. Well, with it being that close, and we had some high reps that was right at 1500, I said, well, hey, you know what? We're going to push forward. I'll take off and I'll check. I'll go out there and kind of do a maneuver just to make sure it's no kidding at 1500 feet. Took off and it was right at 1500 feet. So I fly the profile, and through the profile, I had to start modifying it because out to the west, the rain was a few miles out, but it was destroying the horizon. So right. I was losing that. So you kind of modify the profile, and then fast forward, I finish that and I go to rejoin with the Mustang. And when the Mustang pilot, Jim Beasley, he's like, hey, we're just going to hang back here for a minute and take another turn. And I'm like on his wing looking up at him. And out of the, you know, my corner of my eye, I'm like, God, we are like scraping the treetops here. And I glance in and we're like 700 feet. Well, behind the crowd, the ceiling had sloped down. And in my mind, it was immediate, like, oh, like your credibility is all you have. And I was like, Jim just thinks I flew this entire demo well below my minimums. You know, like, just as a cowboy out here, I was like, hey, no, it's like over the show site, like it's 1500 feet. So we went over the show site and thankfully it was still 1500 feet and we did the heritage flight. But it can be unforgiving. And that's one of the things doing a demo, like there's no reason to push it. So sometimes you just got to call it and hang it up for the day.
Yeah, definitely. So look, just to finish, Rain, so you can reclaim a bit of your weekend, your layover. At the time of recording, your most recent episode is with General Kelly, who, correct me if I'm wrong, is the commander of Air Combat Command.
Correct.
He's a career fighter pilot, an absolutely fascinating interview. Seems like an incredibly sound guy. I mean, you know, we are, again, recording this at the moment. There's turbulent times going on. We've got Russia attacking Ukraine and lots of things with regard to, I guess, air power, etc., are at the forefront of people's minds. I had a couple of bits that I wanted to touch on today, and actually watching your interview with General Kelly has perhaps crystallized a little bit. We've just talked a little bit about aircraft from different generations. Yeah, all right, Extreme, P-51 and F-16, F-35, etc. When you think about the battle space now, with the newest aircraft that we've got, that battle space has got bigger and bigger, hasn't it? I guess for the individual pilot and the individual aircraft, how do we fit an aircraft like, I'm going to use the F-16 because it's the best example, how does that fit into the modern day battle space? Because that battle space is a different size for all of these aircraft, isn't it, when they're cross generation. Is that a huge issue when it comes to planning and executing?
I think it depends on the battle space.
Does that even make sense, that question?
It does. And again, I think it depends on the battle space, right? If you're talking Afghanistan, uncontested environment, you know, the F-16 is a great platform to be able to go from point A to point B very quickly in the country. So you can cover a lot of ground if you don't want a big footprint there, and then go out there and do close air support. In a contested environment, the things start changing, right? That's when, you know, you need an F-35 and you need F-22s to go out there and kick down doors and do things, as well as some other components like cyber and space. But, you know, it's interesting. I say, you know, I guess it's probably not the best phrase to watch Ukraine. It's amazing to watch their Air Force and what they're doing right now. And I don't know the threat lay down, but obviously I know some of the toys that Russia has. And the fact that it does sound like the ghost of Kiev, I think his call sign's Grey Wolf, is actually a real person. And I think unfortunately he just passed. But the fact they're able to go out there and do what they're able to do with fourth gen, 3.5 gen type fighters is incredible. But if you look at the next fight, and I say next fight, which, I mean, gosh, when General Kelly and I recorded the episode, It was February 4th, you know, and we had some offline discussion about, you know, Russia in particular, and, you know, what was going to happen and we thought was going to happen. And, you know, here we are today on the, you know, the 26th, and it's a completely, I guess, not different story, but things are coming true, right? But the next fight, right? Near peer adversaries. General Kelly, you know, I think he brought some salient points. Like, we tend to think everything is okay, or don't worry about big bad people when everything is going well at home. And I think this is a testament that, you know, we have to be prepared. Like, there are state actors out there that would like nothing more to be the predominant power influencer in the world. And I think we're seeing those moves now, and maybe we'll see more moves in the future. So near peer threats have advanced capabilities that we have to go out there and meet. So we have to keep modernizing. And I think that's a part of everyone has to keep modernizing their technological capabilities and their weaponry. If we want to keep people in check, that's just my opinion.
He was refreshingly open for a military commander. I may be being a little unfair. I can't imagine seeing a Royal Air Force guy sitting and perhaps talking in some of the terms that General Kelly was talking to you. He was very open about perhaps the your pilots need to fly more on a regular basis, as we said about equipment. And he used one wonderful phrase. He said, we think a lot more about banks than tanks, which I thought was quite pertinent. Were you surprised at how open he was, or is that what you would have expected to get from him, or indeed maybe any of the commanders?
I guess, I've known him for a while now, so I guess I expected that of him, to at least have that candor there. I don't think that is necessarily normal, right? I mean, just being the way it is, like a guy like him who's towards the end of his career, he's looking at the next thing, which maybe he continues on the Air Force with being the chief of staff. Maybe he retires. But if he retires, you know, our upper echelon tends to find themselves in the defense sector. Again, this is Rain's humble opinion, which doesn't matter much. But, you know, we have some serious problems, and I think it probably translates across various nations, like the KC-46. Yeah, this is a 767 that had already been modified to be a tanker in the commercial space. And it took almost 20 years to be able to give gas to an F-16, or certified to give gas to an F-16 out the back end of it. Like, we can't do business that way if we want to win. So there are people who make a lot of money off this stuff. And it's not necessarily a good thing. It's not the days of World War II when, hey, we're going to pump out 4,000 P-38s in a couple of years. And the reason an F-16 Block 670 costs the same price or just under the price of an F-35, I'll leave that open to interpretation. But it's interesting, right? Like, people are making money doing this. So it was refreshing to hear them say that, because things are not – and especially lower echelons, I don't think people think things are rosy. And being honest with yourself to assess those weaknesses, I think, is a very important thing to do. Not all nations do that, right? Like, the North Koreans probably propaganda videos.
Yeah.
So knowing your weaknesses so you can then fix them is important. We have some serious, I think, things to overcome with the way we procure items, our logistics process, in order to make things more fluid and more cost effective. And Jello on the Fighter Pilot Podcast, I think it was about last year this time, he had a colonel from DARPA on his podcast. And I need to go back and listen to it, but it was a undersecretary of the Army who actually did a study back in the 80s. And, you know, with the graphs, figured out the way we procure items, the way we do contracting in the United States, by like 2050, we'll be able to buy a plane, right, if we continue down this path. The way things get so expensive. And so far, everything has been hitting on that mark, you know, because it's, hey, we're going to buy 900 F-22s. And then we end up buying 185, but that cost is divvied up, you know, or sold initially like, well it's going to be this per unit cost. Yeah. And then turns out it's $300 million per copy. So I don't know. It's good to hear him talk about that stuff. We need more of it, because I don't think things are that rosy. And if you really get down to the tactical level, we're worried about producing fighter pilots, retaining fighter pilots, and translate that to various different career fields. I don't think we're doing a great job of it. And we need to do things differently.
I mean, retention's been a huge issue over here as well, I think. And but to hear him, you guys say that, you know, pilots are flying 8 or 9 hours a month, is that right? I mean, 2 hours a week or whatever, that's seems just unbelievably low.
It is, right? And I'm not in the squadron right now, right? And so I get this stuff secondhand from buddies who are still flying. And I think it varies depending on what squadron you're in and where, you know, because the money flows to different places. This squadron might be getting ready to deploy. So these guys are going to be full up versus a squadron that is coming off a deployment. They're not. And everything is up for cutting. And as politics change, as focuses change, that stuff has a trickle down effect that impacts all the way down to the fighter squadron. So, you know, with a young wingman only getting a couple reps a month at flying, like that's not enough. That's not enough to be proficient. It's almost laughable, I think. And again, this is a more complex problem than this discussion here. But our iron is older than it has ever been, right? You know, we have fewer fighter squadrons than ever. And Desert Storm, I think they say, you know, like the average life or the average age of the aircraft was 8 years. Don't quote me on that, but it's somewhere in the ballpark there. And then we had 330 plus fighter squadrons. And then you fast forward to, you know, 2000 to 2022. We've been engaged in continuous combat operations across the globe. We now have half the number of fighter squadrons. And then the average age of the aircraft is 30 years or so. Like that takes a toll on everything across the force. So, interesting problems. I will say that, you know, at least the glimmer of hope, I do agree with General Kelly, is that I think when, not that you want to be put, have your back put against the wall to react, but when we do find ourselves there, I think, you know, collectively, we all kind of come together to figure it out.
Yeah.
It's nice to be proactive versus reactive.
No, definitely. Definitely. Anyway, it's another brilliant episode. I would highly recommend anyone goes and listens to it if they haven't. John, just to finish, plans for the future. Is there anything you're going to carry on in the same vein? Is there anything different you've got up your sleeve, or where you asked General Kelly, you know, what keeps him awake at night, and you know, what keeps you awake at night with the Afterburn podcast? Anything?
Well, what keeps me awake at night is two 4 month old twins. The Afterburn, I think I go back and forth on this, right? Like, as you're doing it, and you've done it much longer than me. Like, it is a tremendous amount of work. I enjoy it, so I have thought about how will it evolve. I do have some things in the work and another pursuit that I'm really excited about, that I can't give away too much but it's probably a year or so, a year and a half out, if it does come to fruition. For the podcast, you know, I'm developing a new like podcast studio in my home. I hope to have some more in-person interviews.
Yeah.
We'll see where it goes. The challenge for me right now, I have a very demanding and weird schedule. There's no shortage of potential very interesting guests. And like right now, I got like 10 people that I'm kind of talking to and kind of queuing up.
Yeah, there's always someone to talk to. That's the great thing about this.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of value in it. It's just, it is a tremendous amount of work, but keeping it going is right now, it's the nearest alligator to the boat with all the things that are going on. So, yeah.
I've had one idea while we've been talking, actually. So before we go, I'm just going to mention it to you and see what you think. But listen, thank you so much. I know you're a long way from home. You're a bit closer to me than you are to home at the moment. But it's a Saturday lunchtime. You're on your layover. You've given you time to come and talk to Extended. I'm ever so grateful, and I've really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for having me on here. I really appreciate it and very grateful that you had me on.
Thanks, Ray.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
The cockpit's very cramped. You've got leg restraints on. You're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Knowing how to recognise a store, being taught like visually and the basic PPL, it wouldn't bother me.
Thanks for listening to Extended. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended!
This is XTP Media.